Welcome to The Point, an interview series in which we talk to interesting people about the turning points in their lives and careers, brought to you by Point Six. Today's episode is with someone we know very well. It's Point Six's creative director, Russ Hodgson. Russ joined Point Six in 2009, bringing decades of experience from the world of advertising and marketing with him. A few years later, he became a joint owner of the agency, and with his co-directors, has been driving the agency forward in the decade since. A singer-songwriter, open mic night co-host, and avid biker, Russ has a varied palette when it comes to hobbies outside of his professional life. In our chat, we talk about his early work experiences, the dreaded imposter syndrome, becoming an agency owner, how to create a positive work culture, his once-in-a-lifetime trip to Australia, and how having kids represented a huge turning point in his life. So without further ado, here is The Point with Russ Hodgson. Hi Russ, thank you for joining me. How are you? And how's your year been? We're recording this in nearly November 2024. Yeah, how's 2024 been treating you?
Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here. So yeah, lots of positive change and growth at Point Six. So I've been enjoying that dynamic. I've been enjoying my life outside of work too. So especially co-curating a West London open mic along with Sally, one of our Point Six partners.
Yeah, I've heard it's been going well. You were featured on a list of best open mic nights recently. Is that right?
Yeah, I think we lucked out. We got in touch with a local music college, and they just obviously liked us and put us in one of their top 10 London open mics. So yeah, that we'd only done four, which so quite surprising. But yeah, so far so good, and you know, it's a really enjoyable night. It's Abbey Road as well. So, yeah.
The famous Abbey Road.
Famous Abbey Road. But some people have said, oh, well, at the studios. And we've had to say, no. I mean, Paul McCartney's not sound checking, you know. It's actually over the road, but it's an amazing space.
Have you done the walk across the zebra crossing?
Funnily enough, we haven't done the walk. and given that we are working with two sound tech mates, that are actually four of us. So there's nothing stopping us. I think we might just be a bit busy getting on with doing a night. And, we should make some time for that. Yeah, you're right. Who's going to be barefoot? That's the big question.
Right. Okay. So we've known each other for a while, Russ.
Yeah.
I've only ever known you in your capacity as a creative director at Point Six.
So
first of all, I want to take a bit of a trip down memory lane and talk about some of your earlier experiences. So you didn't just wake up one day as a creative director.
No, wasn't as simple as that.
How did the story start? Did you go to college, university? What did you study?
Yes. So I wanted to be a fine artist when I was young. I was drawing. I didn't really like school much. So I left as soon as I could at 16, and I started studying art and design at a little kind of cottage art school in Reigate in Surrey, very kind of sleepy little town. And it was amazing. So I did an art foundation, which these days is a one-year thing. Then it was a two-year thing. So we're talking late 70s here when I started freshman school. And it seems now with hindsight so luxurious. I mean, we did everything. My first day was doing life drawing, standing up all day, and did that for a whole year. It's incredible. Studied sculpture, learned to set hot metal type, which is how newspapers used to be printed. Even though that was a dying technology then, that's what we did. All sorts of incredible things, and it was amazing design training.
Did you feel like you were in the right place? Because I'm kind of fascinated by this idea that 17-year-olds are forced to pick the course that's going to kind of define the rest of their careers, really. I think it's quite a lot of pressure for someone quite young. And so did you feel like your art degree was, you were in the right place, you were doing the right thing?
It's a really good question. And I absolutely felt that, these are my people. I definitely felt for the first time in my life in an educational sort of setting, really, that I was in the right place. But I think what young people now are forced to do is decide really, really quickly. The world of kind of art foundations now, you've got to choose which one you want to do before you even start. Whereas I had the luxury of that not to try all these different things out. So it was less prescriptive. And I think that's maybe something that's missing with particularly design education now. You're meant to know and have a clear view already. So yeah, I agree with that. I think it's tough at a young age to know. And also, you know what, you might try something and it isn't for you. So yeah, I think that multidisciplinary approach, for whatever reason, doesn't really happen anymore. And it's a shame.
Did you have a clear idea of what you wanted to do straight afterwards? Were you even thinking about the next step, or were you just focused on the kind of degree?
I discovered I wasn't a fine artist, and for whatever reason, I was just better at graphic design. So I continued at that college. I did a 3-year graphic design course, and yeah, and then kind of set my sights on being a designer. So yeah, it's interesting because I thought I was one thing, and then it turned out I was really better at something else. So that was a change, actually, which I know is really what this podcast is all about, actually, talking about change moments.
So let's fast forward a little bit. So you graduate, and then your first foray into the world of marketing, with, you know, the industry which you're in now, is at Austin Knight, which is at the time one of the country's biggest local government recruitment agencies. From there, you moved to Stafford Long, an award-winning employer communications agency. And then you arrive at Point Six in 2009. And you very much specialised in employer branding before that. And we have a lot of discussions here about branding, both internally and with our clients. But to me, it seems that employer branding can sometimes get overlooked a little bit. Can you give us a little bit of an outline of what employer branding is exactly, and why it is important, and maybe talk about some of your most memorable or impactful projects?
Maybe if I just backtrack really quickly, because...
Yeah, go for it.
I think another thing that I would just want to talk about was that idea of, and in fact, you asked about this, did I have a career plan? I'd love to tell you that I had a clear career plan. And then I successfully executed that plan. Honestly, it's not true. The reality of going from education into work was that actually I just needed a job. I'd left home, and after trying to get a job in design and failing a few times, I was actually about to start work as a motorcycle courier, which frankly is my only other skill, riding a motorcycle, before landing a job. So I started off, and this is relevant. Actually, I started off in 1984. In my first job, meeting someone who's become a very good friend of mine, and he's actually the founder of Point Six, so David. So that was also kind of quite a significant moment. I then moved to another agency and kind of learned my craft, if you like, in advertising, before ending up at Austin Knight in Soho Square, which was a very different experience. And I think in those days, you tended to work for either public sector or commercial sector clients. And I think the world of employer branding hadn't really been thought about. And it's something that kind of happened along the way. I think over time we realized, okay, well, there is such a thing as an employer brand. And to be honest, it's really an extension of the brand itself, except it's a little bit different, I suppose. It focuses on employee prospects. So, you know, you might be marketing that to people who haven't joined yet. You might be also talking to people within the company, but there needs to be a synergy. If you can't have an employer brand that completely doesn't match up with the brand itself. So I think those values that a company has need to, you know, they need to join up with their employer brand. Otherwise, it's not really a true promise.
Do you agree that it does get overlooked in kind of people focus on the external marketing as almost the top priority?
I think it's true, yeah. It can be overlooked, but then you see some companies doing it extremely well and they surprise you. But yes, you're right. I did spend quite a long time working in that world where we're really looking at what it means to work within a company, the promise that you get and that you can, you know, hope will be your kind of career trajectory within that company. It's funny how branding sort of drops off as soon as you go inside an organization. I'm sure we've all seen examples of that, you know, that there's the public image, but then you sort of visit corporate offices and they've come up with some crazy thing that looks nothing like their external brand identity. So I think there's always that tendency to think, oh, it doesn't really apply to us. It's, you know, it's us within the business, within the organization. But honestly, it's every bit as important. You know, if you're projecting an image out, it also needs to be part of what you believe internally, and it needs to be true. So yeah, I think it's a mixed bag. I think the idea of employer branding probably grew around probably in the 80s and 90s. To be honest, I never really expected it to keep going in some ways. I always kind of thought recruitment marketing might have been a fad that died off, but it's still relevant because, you know, you still need good people to join organizations. So yeah, the budget and, you know, the importance is still there.
So just to fast forward now a little bit, in the late 2000s, you joined Point Six as a creative director. Can you tell me a little bit about those early days of Point Six and how recognizable was it from the agency we see today?
Absolutely, yeah. I'd say since I joined in 2009, yeah, it's changed massively in 15 years, I'd say. Not just in size, you know, we are a larger organization now, but also in focus. So at the time, we were a finely tuned branding and packaging agency. That's how I describe it. And working with a big client, so parent and child brand Avent, which Point Six helped to grow from really a kitchen table startup as our first major client. There were other branding and packaging clients, but really there wasn't much in the way of marketing communications work. So the kind of the world I came from, advertising, digital and communications. So that was my main mission, to help grow that. And that's why I joined.
Who was there in terms of the directors who own the agency today? Was Antoine around? Was Sally around?
Yeah, Antoine and Aaron were, and Sally was yet to join. She joined a couple of years after me. So yeah, Aaron is actually our second ever employee, who ended up marrying the first ever Point Six employee. So it's a real kind of fairy tale ending there. But yeah, but really, apart from our senior retoucher Andy, everyone is new since then. But you know, it's 15 years is a long time. But I think other things have changed since then, including the ownership of the agency.
So you mentioned there about ownership changing at Point Six, and you yourself become a joint owner in 2015. As you say, this podcast is all about looking at people's change points in their lives and their careers. How much of a turning point did that represent to you? And talk to me a little bit about your thought process in that moment, some of the factors that impacted your decision.
Yeah, absolutely. It was quite a shift. I remember I had imposter syndrome, and I'm happy to be completely honest about that. It was new. I'd worked for other people for decades, and now here I was as a co-owner, responsible for a whole team's future. Did we know what we were doing? Yeah, mostly. But we made a few mistakes. Having said that, we trust our instincts. We also learned a lot quickly, especially as it was kind of a perfect storm in that year, as our largest client was having a bit of a quiet year and it didn't really have the budgets. And also the exchange rate for the euro against the pound was, it suddenly went really crazily, not in the favour of a UK agency getting work from the EU zone. So it was really a not great environment, but we got through that first year. It was definitely a baptism of fire. And then we started to thrive. I think the secret there really for us was we kept the communication going, not just with clients and internally with our team, but also checking our pulse regularly, if you like. And we still meet every week to check our teams and our business's health. I think this is really important. We've never kind of relaxed, if you like. We're always... we need to know everything's going fine, or if we need to make adjustments, need to make changes. So I think that first year, which was difficult, really put us in a good place to go forward and really helped us to grow into the kind of company that we wanted to be ultimately.
You spoke about imposter syndrome there, the dreaded imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever spoken to any creative or anyone in our industry who hasn't experienced that imposter syndrome at one point or another. Is there any antidote to that imposter syndrome, or is it just something we all have to kind of accept is going to be there? And, you know, because I think it's really inspirational how you know, you mentioned that's how you were feeling at the time, but you went forward anyway, right? Something must have kind of motivated you enough to push through that wall of discomfort.
Yes, it's a great question, actually, imposter syndrome. I'd probably go back to an earlier experience in my career, actually, to talk about that, which is when I was at Stafford Long, the creative director at the time, Gabby, left, and the partners looked externally for, well, they said they were going to look externally for another creative director, and myself and Phil Woodford, who were the senior creators at the time, said, look, we'd like to pitch for this. And we did. And we did it successfully. We ran as joint creative directors for some time before Phil went off to pursue other things. But I think that moment really of becoming creative director for the first time, that was a change as well. You know, and the expectations. Is there a cure for imposter syndrome? I don't think so. I think you've just got to push through it. You've got to embrace new things and you've got to go, okay, it's different now. I'm now someone who is in charge of a department and working with other people in a different way. I'm not their mate anymore. I'm their boss. So, you know, there's a shift there and you just have to embrace what that is. Understand what it is from a positive perspective. Understand that things have changed. Not necessarily in a negative way, but they're just different.
Yeah, I think it's really important to talk about. I think the tendency for someone who's earlier on in their career is to see a business owner, a CEO, a head of department, and think that they've got it all together. You know, they never worry about anything. They're kind of flying and hitting these achievements with flying colours. So it's really important to acknowledge that everybody feels this at some point in their career. I want to talk a little bit about company culture. From my experience at Point Six, it's something that, you know, I probably value above all else, really. But it's something that doesn't just materialise overnight. And you've spoken in the past before about some of your earlier workplaces maybe not necessarily having such a positive culture, or maybe the work-life balance not quite being there. So how much time and effort does it take to create a positive culture? Is it high up on your list of priorities? Is it something you can always control even?
I'm tremendously proud of the working culture we built at Point Six. And it's only happened through hard work from everyone and a mutually supportive team. And that's a fantastic thing to see. And yes, I've definitely worked in some toxic environments in my time, which have affected how I feel about what a workplace should be. And, you know, they just seem normal at the time. And I recently heard design industry guru David C. Baker talk a bit about one of the things that he says is endemic in our industry, which is over-delivery. And at its worst, it's a mindset that says, well, nothing's ever good enough. Unless you've exhausted the possibilities, probably, and yourself as well. And that kind of thing just burns people out. And to give you a bit of an example of what I mean, so I did work in Adland for a long time. And I can remember one quote from a leading Adland figure at the time, and I won't name him, who said about weekend working, which was a pretty typical thing, at least for creatives. And he said, don't come in on a Sunday if you're not prepared to come in on Saturday. And honestly, I don't think you get more done by working longer hours. Okay, so there are times where, you know, yes, we do have deadlines, we might have a presentation, so on. And there are times where we might work outside that core. But do you get more done by working longer hours? I think you actually get less done often. And if you're not careful, people become a commodity. And particularly in ad land, I think the smart, the tireless, the tenacious creatives or creative teams, they dig in, they move up. But a lot of people burn out just trying to keep up with the constant demands of reinvention. And it's bollocks, really. I mean, it isn't how it should be. So change really has to come from the top. And you need people to believe and buy in and share a culture. So, you know, if you're in a kind of a, what I describe as kind of like a cult-like environment where you maybe have a charismatic leader, everyone follows that person and what they do. If they say, right, it's all about work. We all work together. We live together. We share together. And we kind of never go home. That's what that cult does. But if you create a different kind of culture, then you need to live that too. So, you know, it has to be a genuine reflection of the values that you believe in. And I think it also affects your decision-making. So in a challenging situation, whatever that is, I think you also need to ask yourself, okay, if you're not 100% sure, what would we do? And then you act on that. So I'm not saying it's always easy, and we try and get it right, but we're very proud to say we've won some awards, best employer awards, but you know, it's a constant thing. And I think as we grow, as we're growing currently, we're very conscious that we need to try and keep everything going. We need to keep our supportive team culture. We need to make sure that we don't drop the ball and miss things, because it's incredibly important that we carry on, you know, in a positive way.
Yeah, I think it shows. I think when it is top of a list of priorities or near a top of a list of priorities, I think it does really shine through. It's obvious, and I've spoken to people in, you know, my kind of personal life who work in a similar industry who don't necessarily get that sense of support from their team. And I think it's really interesting how you speak about working longer hours not necessarily being conducive to doing better work. I think when it's expected that you work long hours, I think that's what kind of gets people's backs up, really. If it's not expected, I think like you mentioned, people are always happy to muck in if a project needs doing and you're against the kind of wire. I think most people, if they feel supported by their workplace, are happy to work that extra couple of hours and put in the hard yards, but it's when it crosses the line to you're expected to work longer hours.
Yeah, I actually have a couple of observations as well. And I know I've been talking about how long hours culture, in my opinion anyway, isn't productive. So I have a couple of observations about that. One is that a lot of the work that I was doing in advertising was coming up with more ideas and more ideas and more ideas. And sometimes you would take those ideas to a client and say, like this, or like this, or hey, how about like this? And we know actually from the Design Business Association, our client surveys, that actually a significant proportion of clients say that they don't really know how to judge creativity. So isn't it better that an agency comes to a client with a recommendation rather than pushing that responsibility back over to a client and saying, look, maybe like this, maybe like we don't really know. What do you like? So that's kind of one observation. Another one is, okay, so we're not working crazy long hours. Isn't this all terrible news for clients? You know, wouldn't it be better if we really were putting those extra hours in, you know, really, really, really working that brief, making sure, and as I've already said, I think exhausting yourself, it's not the way to go. So if you're a client, who would you rather have working on your account? Someone exhausted and past caring, or someone plugged in who genuinely understands you and what you're trying to do? So that would be my question, and also my answer to this agency doesn't do extended hours and works all hours and weekends to deliver. Which is the better option for you?
Yeah, it's a no-brainer, but why does not everybody do it? In that, if it seems so clear, why is there this kind of culture in a lot of agencies of working yourself to the bone?
I think there's something about the creative mindset, which is that often we're never satisfied. I mean, I know this from my own experience. I just want to do a good job. And sometimes I'm annoyed that there isn't the budget to do X, Y, Z. I just want to do, sometimes you just want to do something really cool. You want to go, actually, no, let's do it. And you've got your financial head on, or maybe your account manager saying, look, we've got X amount of time to do this, and there's something else to do. And it's a tendency as a creator to go, oh, can we just do a bit more there? And yes, we always can. But should we? And I think that's really the question. And maybe we can. Maybe we can do it later. But maybe we also need to factor the time in for that. Do it properly as well. So I think it's maybe just a tendency as creative beings to just want to keep going with something. And it isn't in our nature to say no to ourselves.
I want to step outside of your professional life for a moment now.
Okay.
And talk about something which we mentioned a bit at the top. Music. Music's always been a huge passion of yours.
Absolutely.
Both as a fan and a performer as well. And as we said, you and Point Six's managing director, Sally, and friend of yours, host an open mic now night on Abbey Road. It started to gain a bit of a reputation. And you know, budding artists turn up, performers turn up. Is it just music that people play, or is it any kind of performance art?
It's music. I mean, people have asked us if they could do spoken word, and we've said no, politely. But it's music and it's singing. So it's really music based open mic. But what that could be is whatever you want. I mean, it's actually an incredible church that we get to borrow once a month, and it's not a religious event. They're happy for us to run a not-for-profit community open mic there. So we've had a cappella choirs, singer-songwriters. I mean, it is electric, but it kind of feels a bit unplugged. And it's a whole mix. You know, we've had, recently we've had some really kind of quite young performers coming and doing like electro-pop stuff, playing to backing tracks. We've had people singing blues, soul. We've got some regulars. The standard's really pretty good. Some performers are professional or semi-professional. But there's a clue in the name. It's an open mic. So we invite anyone in. If they want to maybe step it up, take it to the next level. It's an incredible space to do that. And I think it lifts the performance that anyone gives there just because of the acoustics in that place.
We spoke about burnout a second ago, and I just want to know how you find time, how you manage to juggle, you know, your one of your passions, music, with your career, and you know, whilst also raising a family at the same time. I know your kids are kind of grown up now, but you know, there must have been a time where you had to juggle all of these things.
Yeah, I mean, it's fair to say that I really only got into, well, certainly performing and running music nights, only about 10 years ago. So I've been a music fan all my life. How long have you got? I can tell you lots about that. But really, learning to play music was a quite transformational thing in itself. I spent maybe 7 years rehearsing at Grove Studios, which isn't there anymore, a rehearsal space down in Ladbroke Grove. And the really cool thing about that was often famous people would come in, but everyone's the same in that situation, really. Everyone is pretty cool. You know, when you're making a cup of tea at half time, you know, people just chat with you. I guess I've made the time for really what I wanted to do, but you have to make choices. And I can only really do that because my kids were older. So it kind of allowed me the time. Again, it's just about what you prioritize. So I think probably my third place is making music.
Let's talk about another potential change point in your life. People probably wouldn't be able to tell from the accent, but you were actually born in Australia.
It's true.
you moved to England with your parents when you were very young.
Yeah, it's true. So I was actually three on the boat, and it was the boat. This is 1966, so this is prehistory. And I don't remember too much, but I do have one early memory. So I must have been, well, I was two. And I remember crawling under the house that we lived in. This is in a suburb in North Melbourne where I was born. And houses are a bit different in Australia. Some of them are kind of, a lot are made of wood, and they're often lifted up above the ground. And I crawled under there to have a look at a green canoe, apparently, which was under there. And it's quite, it must have been quite a small space. So I remember my dad sort of coaxing me back out again. But that's pretty much it. So that's, in terms of memories, it's a really early memory, but I don't really have a lot else that I can kind of go back and tell you about.
Do you have any memories from first arriving in the UK and kind of how your, if you don't have memories yourself, how your parents might have felt around that time? Were you aware of any kind of difficulties in that period, you know, around adaptation?
I think kind of moving to another English-speaking country is obviously going to be a lot easier than, say, coming to this country, as a lot of people did around that. We're talking kind of like the Windrush generation. So a lot of sort of former British colonies, you know, people coming to the UK. I think for me, growing up in England was easy, but my dad never lost his accent. And I think a little bit of him never really left Australia. Whereas my mum loved England, and she ended up speaking like the Queen. So I think it was probably different for each of them. I think there's always that little bit of, you know, suddenly I'm in a small market town in Sussex. Yeah, we're not from around here, but it wasn't really that difficult that I remember growing up. I think it would have been a lot harder if, say, they'd been Italian or, you know, English wasn't their native tongue.
Yeah, no huntsman spiders in Sussex either.
That is a useful thing about England compared to Australia. There's really nothing that's likely to cause you much harm out there in nature, that's for sure.
So last year you decided to take a sabbatical, and you took a few months out of work to go on what you described as a trip of a lifetime, and that was back to Australia with nothing much else than a motorbike and a backpack and some travel essentials. What motivated you to go on this adventure? Would it be fair to say that it was a journey of self-discovery in a way, or is it a bit more simple than that? Was it really just about combining some of your hobbies?
Yeah, I never expected to have a life-changing experience. I mean, I may well have had one despite that. But yeah, I went for three reasons. One, because, yes, I wanted to do a big motorcycle trip, and having grown up pretty much riding motorcycles, well, from the age of 13, I was riding off-road on motorcycles. I've never really done a big trip. You know, I've been around a bit of Europe, but I've never done a big trip. So that was a big one, 7,000 kilometres from Perth, which is in the southwest of Australia, up through Western Australia, which is, for context, is 11 times the size of the UK. And it's only a third of the land mass of Australia. So it's a big continent. So yeah, the first reason was just to do a big trip, and it was amazing. Although I had to dodge quite a bit of wildlife, which is everywhere. Probably the biggest hazard, apart from myself doing something stupid, was the wildlife.
Did you have any runnings with anything scary?
Well, I took some good advice. So this is I took a couple of other things, including a satellite phone and a tent, and you know, some kind of essentials to kind of get me out of jail if things went really wrong, basically a satellite phone. I went around a corner once, and there aren't that many corners on the kind of roads I was riding on, and there was a family of wild pigs that luckily didn't run across the road, but they ran sort of the other way, which that would have been interesting. But generally, yeah, the advice was don't ride early, don't ride late. Basically, the road's just covered in animals, including those ones that bounce along. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, at the beginning and end of the day. So, yeah, you have to kind of condense your journey. And it was Australian winter as well, because when I got up north, It just gets insanely hot in the summer, up in the mid-40s. So I did the journey in winter, and of course the days were shorter.
Did you manage to reconnect with any family over there, or did you visit the place where you were born?
I didn't actually. Yes, the third reason was to see if I could reconnect with the country I was born in. And also because my parents haven't been around for a while, to see some places where they grow up. And I have a couple of cousins in Australia, one in the west, one in the east. So that was really handy. So my cousin Neil showed me some places where my dad grew up. And he was from an immigrant family, moved there in the mid sort of 1920s. He was born in 1929. One really enduring memory for me, which is just fabulous. Neil had done a bit of detective work because there was a little town called Yarloop where my dad lived when he was very young. And it had a bushfire there about 15 years ago. And it took out quite a lot of the town, including this house where my dad lived. And these things were pretty much tar paper shacks. You know, they're really basic, but they were still there. But they weren't there because the bushfire had come through. And Neil remembered when he was young, my dad telling him about a lemon tree that was in the backyard of this property. So he went looking for where the house might have been. There's no sign of the house, but there was a lemon tree. So he took me to see that lemon tree. He just did some detective work on it. And I thought, that's fantastic. He suddenly realized, that's where the house must have been. So that was a really, really nice moment. So it's a bit of, you know, kind of living history there, even if the house had gone, but, you know, somehow it survived that bushfire.
Must have been a surreal experience seeing some of these places. Did you take any lessons that you perhaps learned on your trip back with you to the UK?
Yeah, I think a couple. I mean, the first, which is, I think, universally true, that we are all basically the same. I met so many great people. I met, white Australians like myself. I met quite a few First Nation Australians, so probably Aborigines, as most people would call them. And I was, I was keen to hear different perspectives about modern Australia. I was probably following Australian kind of news and politics for about 18 months before I went, so I wanted to go informed, not just as a tourist. But I learned a lot, and it's probably a whole separate podcast to talk about the state of Australia right now. It's a complicated country. There are many fantastic things and many challenges too. But I suppose the other thing that's, I would say, I learned, well, I definitely learned through traveling, which I would say you could apply to life actually in any situation, is if things change, then be prepared to change with them. Don't ignore them and keep going. Reset, reroute. And if this sounds like I'm really talking in a travel context, yes, in this context, as well as metaphorically, because this literally saved me once. I was trying to cross the first of three rivers that should be crossable at that time of year on a motorcycle. But the amount of rain that Australia had over the previous 6 months, the floodwaters were still going down. And that just gives you a sense of how big the country actually is and how much it will soak up. And then, it was still coming out of the ground. If I hadn't turned around at that point and changed my route, it wouldn't have ended well. I was also traveling alone. So, that taught me something. If something changes, be prepared to change with it. The people you hear about going on adventures and something went badly wrong, often people who just stick to the plan in that, right, no, this is what I'm doing, head down way, and not look at the facts, if you like, what's actually going on. So, be prepared to change because sometimes you have to.
I think that's a really important message, and, you've described it in a kind of really practical context there, but it's almost an allegory for life, right? I think people can become entrenched in their beliefs or set on the path that they're on. But I think that's a really important message. If the evidence changes, the situation changes, be prepared to adapt.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was a big takeaway. I also had to recognize it myself at the time, which wasn't so easy, as I was trying to push a bike through a river. But but I realized it wasn't a good plan going forward because it was quite literally only going to get worse. So, yeah, I mean, sometimes you've got to have a word with yourself. And I think that was that moment for me where I did.
Listen, we're going to start to wrap things up now. I've just got a couple of closing questions for you.
Yeah, sure.
And thank you for being so open and insightful. We've covered a lot of ground. We've spoke about quite a few change points in your life, from going to university, going to art school, starting your career in marketing, becoming a co-owner of an agency, and going on a kind of once in a lifetime trip. With hindsight on your side, because, you know, we have to have a healthy helping of hindsight with this podcast. What is the biggest turning point of your career or your life?
Yeah, I think that's an easy one. 1992, when I first became a parent. So suddenly you're responsible for another life. And it was amazing and mind-blowing. And it's still a pleasure and a privilege. And, you know, I'm lucky enough to have three kids. And I'll probably, well, forever call them kids because, you know, that's how it feels. So it was particularly a big thing for me for context. As a teenager, I had cancer. And by the way, I'm absolutely fine talking about this. I know how emotive cancer is as a topic, understandably. So at the time, it was very hard, but I had an amazing doctor. She was trying some kind of new chemo treatment. She said, look, I think it's going to work. I think it's going to be right. Do you want to do it? And I said, yeah. And it obviously works, zero. But though she also told me that I probably wouldn't be able to have kids. So that moment when it turned out that, hey, you know, I could was a huge moment because it was like a compounded moment. So,
yeah,
you know, that was it was a massive thing for me. And if I had to pick one, that would be it.
That's incredible. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I had no idea, but that's, adds another extra layer to the kind of incredibly emotional moment that it is becoming a parent. And
yeah.
I wouldn't know. I'm not a parent myself,
yeah.
But you know, there must be something so special about it. If so many people kind of describe this life-changing feeling of when you become a parent and suddenly, as you say, you're not just responsible for yourself. You've got a literal little human to look after.
You have. And it's that moment when you kind of bring it back from the hospital and it's like, oh right, it's down to us now, you know, we need to not mess this one up. But it is an incredible experience, and and it has been.
So finally then, what advice would you give to somebody who feels like they're at a crossroad or a change point in their life or career? And
I think we've talked quite a lot about change, actually, and I would say change, in a way, be prepared to embrace it. Change is a constant. It's unavoidable. In fact, everything changes all the time. You maybe don't recognize it, but as you know, we talked about a lot of my life here. So you age, things happen, little things happen, big things happen as well. But of course, some changes are bigger. So when a big change happens, be true to yourself. Do listen to advice, but ultimately trust your gut instinct and you'll work it out.
That's great. That's perfect. Thank you very much. And thank you for your time. And that's a great note to end on. That's what we're trying to achieve with this podcast, is to inspire people to not be freaked out by these change points, and perhaps not to overthink what's happening at times. Thank you very much for speaking to us about your life and being so open about some of the key events in your life there as well.
No, thanks, Lewis. You've asked me some fantastic questions, and it's it's been an absolute pleasure.
Where can people find you? You're on LinkedIn, right? And
yes, you'll find me on LinkedIn. You'll also find me on the Point Six website. You'll also find me at musically at Dark Habit Music, one word, actually named after a coffee shop in Queen's Park that no longer exists. And that's how our open mic side hustle. If you want to come play down at the Abbey Road Baptist Church on a first Monday, again, shameless plug.
Yeah, do go check that out because, yeah, it sounds amazing. Thank you very much, Russ.
Thanks, Lewis.
And there we have it. A really open, honest and all-round lovely chat with Russ Hodgson. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. To keep up with The Point, make sure you follow Point 6 Design on LinkedIn and Instagram. And if you liked it, please leave us a review on your podcast app or drop us a comment on our socials. It really does help us out. Thank you for listening to The Point. I've been Lewis Rolfe and we'll see you next time.